This episode of Sessionable is brought to you by Dave's Travel and Events Group, voted Best Tour and Transport Operator in the New South Wales Tourism Awards. If you want to know why they're award-winning, why not check out one of their great beer experiences, like their half-day or full-day tours of Canberra. You know, for the longest time, Canberra has been known for two things: legal fireworks and... Oh no, I can't mention that second thing, can I? Questacon? Let's say Questacon. But it should be known for three things, really. And that third thing is its ever-expanding beer scene. So if you'd like to check out the great beers of the nation's capital, book a tour now at daves.com.au. Previously on Style Roulette, Doppelbock.
Doppelbock.
9A. No doubt Tom will tell us all about his...
I'm sure he'll...
Do you know Tom went to Germany?
He'll correct all of our pronunciation for an hour.
Sessionable. All right, welcome everyone to Sessionable.
Hey mate, how you going?
I'm a bit dusty today.
A bit dusty?
To be honest.
I wouldn't say I'm fresh, but I'm not slim dusty.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So today we are doing a Style Roulette episode.
Yeah.
It's been a while since the last Style Roulette episode
we didn't actually record, because the last Style Roulette episode was the live Style Roulette for
Sydney. Yeah, how did that go?
It was awesome.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's... Unlike a normal tasting, the one thing when you're doing multiple style roulettes, as in, you know, literally rolling the dice and doing it, is there's no order.
Yeah.
And so I think we came out with some pretty heavy hitters to start with, which at the time I thought was a really bad idea. I think it was like American Strong Ale and Barley Wine or something were the first two. And I was like, oh, that's really shit. This is not going to go so well. But turns out, when you're doing one with John from Bucket Boys, if you give him two really strong beers to start with, he doesn't care what he cracks after that. So it actually turned out to be the most valuable $20 event I've ever seen.
Some whales came out.
Yeah, we cracked some $75 bottles of Thai Speedway Stout.
Fuck.
So it was good. No, it was really good fun, actually. I think we'll definitely do that again. We'll have to figure out a way to record it.
Yeah.
Because, we had 20 people there? So it's sold out, and it was awesome. It was really good fun.
Yeah. I reckon definitely next beer week.
Yeah.
Do it again.
Yeah.
If not before that.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, it was really cool. Everyone didn't have a good time.
Yeah, I was a bit bummed I couldn't make it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, with, you know, John from Bucket Boys, myself, and Chris Cohen from the States. So the three of us were just like nerding out. So it was good fun.
The badges were out.
No, I still never worn my throw badge. Badges weren't out, but they were out in spirit, put it that way.
Yeah.
So it's been so long, I didn't even had to think about what beer we're doing for Style Roulette.
Yeah.
Today,
so. Well, hopefully we got it right, but I believe it was Doppelbock that we rolled last time.
I'm just going to say it's Doppelbock.
Let's
now,
just go with that anyway.
It's going to have to be.
Yeah. So what are we drinking?
So this is the Weinstephaner Corbinian, which is their Doppelbock.
Yep.
And it is, you know, probably the second, the OG is always going to be the Salvatore.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Bucket Boys didn't have it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Get your shit together, Jonathan.
We only had two other double boxes. Yeah. Yeah. But,
This is a good example.
Yeah, it's probably, I'd say, the number two example. Like, if you're going to ask someone what's a double box, my first one would probably be Salvatore.
Yeah.
And second would be Corbinian. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a great classic example. And we know Weinstephaner does very traditional styles of beers, and they do everything very much two style.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm actually very, very excited about this episode because, you know, I kind of cut my teeth on dark German beers when I was getting into beer because they were like...
It was accessibility at the time.
Yeah, well, readily available and also offered something different to just their regular pale lagers.
So, yeah, you're right. I think when I was getting into beer, and like probably we didn't know each other, but we probably would have been around the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
Like what you could get that was not just boring stuff was like German beers and Belgian beers, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Actually, it was easier to get Belgian beers then than it is to get now in some cases. But I think we've got a wider variety of them now.
Yeah.
But it's probably, you're right. There's like, for me, it was probably more Belgian beers than German beers. But that's sort of what I really got into before we had access to everything.
Definitely both at the time. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it is a great beer. And I think the Corbinian and the Weinstephaner Vitus, which is their Weizenbock, are two of my favorite German styles of beers. Yeah, great beers.
So being the style guy, can you talk us through the style, what to expect from the style?
Yeah, so a double bock is a strong bock. Bock is generally means strong anyway.
Yep.
So double bocks are generally, well, I'm pretty sure, always darker. You know, like anything, there's a bit of a range in that. The opinion we've got in front of us is
pretty dark.
It's not. It's pretty close to black. Like it's a dark brown.
I would say dark brown. Yeah.
Yeah, but
apparently there are some pale versions, which I'm not sure if I've even had before.
Every double bock that I can remember having has definitely been on the paler side, but I think there definitely is some double bocks that are a bit lighter in that color. I'm just bringing up my BJCP style guidelines because my phone, because they've got actually a color guide on there.
Okay, yep.
But yeah, so double box, you know, they call it a strong European lager. Alcohol range is, you know, going to be around that 7 to 10% mark. So it is pretty beefy. Do we know what strength the...
This is 7.4, I believe.
So, you know, definitely right in there.
What I was reading, I was going through the style guide earlier and it there is a note later on that says there's no real upper limit to the alcohol or the flavors or anything. This is just like a kind of rough guide.
I think it's where majority of the ones that they say are the style sit in.
Yeah.
I think probably there would be a theoretical upper limit of around 12 to 13%.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's kind of like where you...
Where the yeast stops it's gonna working. Go to. Yeah.
But yeah, like, you know, it doesn't really translate well for podcasts, but like you can see the... Color is actually starts from a quite a dark amber, you know, an amber that goes all the way through to reddish to brown to pretty much black.
Yeah.
So it's a, you know, it's a pretty wide style. I mean, it's not that it's a fact, but I've always, in my mind, thought that double bucks were always darker.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think traditionally they started off dark, but the style guideline was saying in recent times, you know, people have started making pale versions.
And like, you know, I think you're going to do some story time a bit later with the history of it because it's a great history style. But like, from a flavor point of view, you know, it's rich, malty.
And I think that's the kind of main feature of the style is that big malt profile.
Yeah.
The style guideline goes through words like Maillard.
Maillard, which is, you know, that browning of meats.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think another thing that they talk about is it's generally quite well attenuated.
Yeah, so it's a pretty clean.
The sugar. So it's not a, like, some people when they think of European, like, high alcohol dark beers think like that really rich sweet, which is more that Belgium style.
Yeah.
It's actually, like, there's a little bit of sweetness there.
Yeah,
but it's like,
but it's a clean sweetness.
It's clean sweetness. Yeah. And there's not a lot of, like, esters or phenols, which you'd also expect with a quite a high alcohol beer. So it doesn't have a lot of that, you know, banana or clove or that type of stuff. It's actually really clean.
It's super clean.
And it hides its alcohol really well.
And like, I think part of that, like, there's a few different reasons why that's the case. And part of that is because it's a lager and it goes through a lagering process of about 3 months. It kind of just cleans it out. One of the other things that I found in my research was that traditionally, and I think a lot of the German brewers still do this, is they would use a decoction mash.
Yeah.
Which, you know, let's go a bit nerdy for a sec. So what you do, usually like a simple mash, you would just mash at a certain temperature to extract the sugars from the malt before you start brewing. The decoction mash is a multi-step mash where you have different rests at different temperatures that do certain things. What's special about this step mash in particular is that you take about a third of the mash out from the mash tun, boil it in a separate vessel, and then introduce it back. And that's how you get the increase in temperature.
Yep.
And you do that about three times typically. So... each time we'll raise the temperature to a certain temperature that will do something else to the beer. And the kind of the belief is that that process helps it, you know, get this complex malt profile while also, you know, doing what it's meant to do, like extract all the sugars.
Yep. And the way I always like to say it, it's kind of like when you're making like a caramel, so you just got sugar.
Yep.
And you're browning it, it's like, I always like to put things like brewing into cooking for some people. It's kind of like, yeah, you want to make a rich caramel sauce, so you want a quite a dark caramel, but you don't want to burn it. So a safer way of having your whole batch is to take bits of it apart, make that really caramel, and then mix that back into your grater thing. So it's a safer way of doing it. It's kind of a bit like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that, you know, you're talking before about Maillard reaction, and that, that this whole technique is about, because they were using quite simple grains or primitive grain, I guess you could say. Yeah,
so they're not as like kind of well-developed as they are these days.
So they had to do a lot of work to the grains, but also that Maillard reaction and that rich caramel, which is that richness of the beer, that was the main, it was a flavor thing as well as a...
Yeah, I think that definitely helps provide that profile, like the extensive, the extra boiling... they boil the wort for 3.5 hours typically as well, which is insane.
Yeah.
So
you know, a general these days would be like, you know, 90 minutes.
Yeah,
right?
60 or 90 minutes.
60 to 90 minutes. Yeah.
So I think, you know, all those kind of contribute to this really rich, complex malt profile. And like, even though it's a dark beer, like most of the time brewers don't really add that much dark malt. Mm. It's a lot of the kind of complex malt profile is from the process rather than adding coloured malts.
Exactly right. Yeah, yeah. And so it's what's giving you that dry, malty richness without sweetness.
Yeah, yeah.
The other thing is it's a very labour-intensive process and style of brewing.
Yeah.
It takes a long time.
Yeah.
You know, if you're doing, I think even in a homebrew setting, if you're doing like a decoction mashing, that's your whole day done.
Yeah.
You're not getting another brew in after that. Like, it's a very intensive process, and you know, it's traditionally done for a reason. Modern brewers do sometimes say that due to the advancements in the malts that we have now, that it's not a necessary thing, but it's only really that if you want to try to replicate these rich German and European style flavors that you would do it. But yeah.
I kind of wonder if anyone's released like a modern double bock with, you know, using a simple mash and not lagering it for that long, if they can replicate the same flavor profile.
I would be very impressed if someone could, because I think there's a certain level of depth and richness that you get in these beers that I don't know another way you could do it. I'm not a brewer, but I'd be very impressed if someone could pull that off.
So what are we tasting in this one in particular?
Well, first I just want to say I really like it.
Yeah.
I think it's
great.
Awesome.
I haven't had it for so long.
Yeah, like I said, just really, it's complex, really complex. But that, like, being showy, it's not like Imperial Stout, which is going to really boozy or strip your palate. Yeah. It's complex but quite subtle in the way it does it at the same time.
Complex and delicate.
Delicate. And I think that dryness has a big part to do with that as well.
I wouldn't guess it was 7.5%, but it is.
On the nose, I get sort of like a dried fruit, like a raisin sort of a thing. Mm. I've heard like other tasting notes of like things like dried prunes and stuff like that. So it's, if you know, like, and that's basically the sun taking out of the water. So you've got a really basically like you're dehydrating a grape or whatever, fruit too. Like, it's essence of super richness and sugarness. And this has kind of got that without that super sweetness as well.
Yeah.
A bit of toast. Like, there's a slightly bit of like,
yeah, definitely.
Like, without being astringent, a little bit of like a burnt character in the end.
Yeah, like a toasted bread kind of thing. Yeah.
But just like, and kind of a bit like molasses. Like, it's a really like treacly, like really that dark, that dark sweetness, I guess. Yeah.
The other M that they use is melanoidins.
Melanoidin. Do you know what melanoidin is?
No. I read the word in several articles, but I don't actually know what it is.
Melanoidin is a style of malt.
But it's a character as well, right?
It's an altered...
It's like, I think it's like complex compounds made through the process of brewing, right?
And I think you can buy melanoidin or malt these days to do some of that replication, but I will have to clarify that, because I did ask someone about a brewer about this really recently, and it kind of just went in one ear and straight out the other.
I think it's like a kind of, it's like a compound that is created through certain processes, and certain malts like melanoidin malt and Munich malt have a very kind of good at producing that character. So you'd typically find Munich malt in a lot of the grist in these beers, in Doppelbocks.
So these days they use melanoidin malt instead of having to do decoction mashing. So it's a modified malt.
cheating.
It is it's a bit of a cheating model. Yeah. So it gives that sort of rich character.
Yeah.
So it's a kind of a so you, without having to do that big process. Yeah. So yeah, a lot of the like Weimann and other German malt producers do produce this, but yeah, it is seen as a bit of a shortcut. But you can use it in other beers that aren't decoction mashing to add a bit more body and mouthfeel to it as well. What else are you getting? Flavors. I feel like it's kind of like we talked about its richness, but I think it's more about what's not there. And like that hot alcohol, that fusel alcohol is definitely not there.
No, yeah, no hot at all. No cloying sweetness.
Yeah. Finish is quite dry, right?
Super
quite,
dry. Yeah.
So it's called what? Well attenuated. So it's fermented out a lot of the sugars. Yeah.
Yeah.
Bitterness. I'm not like, are you getting any hop character at all?
Not really.
No.
Yeah, I think like, you can have hops, but it's usually like you don't want it to stand out at all because you want the malt to be the hero.
Yeah, the malt's the front and center of this beer, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, they say in the style guidelines that, you know, virtually no hop aroma, although some light, noble hop character is acceptable. And like, you know, those noble hops are a bit more like earthy and woodsy. And
yeah.
So, you know, it's definitely a bit more like subtle.
And like, yeah, it's a German German style. So, yeah, you would expect German, you know, like traditional noble hops.
Yeah, or something like
that. That kind of thing. Like European, European hops rather than anything
as it's actually
American.
Warming up, there is becoming a bit more of a like a lager like geese character coming to it. I'm getting a bit of that sort of Euro lager, not in a like a light struck way, but just in that sort of that yeast character starting to become a bit more prominent.
Yeah,
still really nice, but you know, mouthfeel is like it's a really big, rich beer as well, isn't it? I was actually, as you said before, I'd be really interested if anyone knows of a brewery, a modern brewery. As in, not a brewery, like a classic German brewery who makes a style, but a modern, maybe even Australian or American brewery who's doing the style of beer, who's doing decoction mashing. I'd be really interested to find that out.
I'm not actually sure if anyone does it. I'm sure there are a couple in Australia that do it, but I'm just not sure. But yeah, it'd be interesting.
I mean, it is a filling beer, right?
Yeah.
The monks used to drink this beer as while they were fasting.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is a bit... it's a rich filling beer. Like, you know, it's a bit of vitamin B in there. I think it'll keep you going for a little while.
Yeah, it's so came from Munich. Salvatore was the original, and usually a lot of the names have a Tor on the end as like a kind of tribute to that.
Salvatore?
Yeah, to Salvatore.
Yeah.
Corbinian is one of them that doesn't have.
Yeah, Corbinian's one of the few. I mean, like a few others, like so Eyinger do the Celebrator, I think it's called. Celebrator.
Yeah, okay.
Spaten's, I love theirs, it's the Optimator. It's just like full like Optimus Prime.
Yeah.
What are some other ones? There are some there's a few others, but yeah, that they're all just these big, strong, you know. They sound like a Marvel like villain character or something, like Optimator.
And there's certain breweries do an icebox version of their Doppelbox as well. So, and we'll probably get to this in a future episode. But basically, that's they freeze distill the beer.
Yeah. So it's a way of distilling a beer to make it. It's a quite a rudimentary way of increasing it higher to make a beer, distill it to make it higher alcohol.
Yeah.
Classically, it's a technique that sort of came back into modern focus with BrewDog and Tactical Nuclear Penguin, which sort of started that, you know, the early 2000s arms race, I guess you could say, for booziest beer.
Yeah.
And that came about because I think the brewery at the time there was an ice cream factory next door to them.
Right.
So they had access to like a industrial deep freezer.
That makes sense. Yeah, I didn't know that story.
They just rolled in. And the whole idea is you're freezing beer and, you know, 85 to 90% of the beer is water anyway. So that's what's going to freeze.
Yeah.
So you just scoop out the ice chunks and what you're doing is removing the water. So every time you remove water, what remains is the alcohol.
Yeah.
And so as your volume, your mass of beer goes down, but your alcohol percentage goes up.
Yeah.
So it's a very expensive way to make beer because I'm not sure what the loss rate is, but if you start with 100 liters, you probably maybe end up
you lose so much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
considering that you could, you know, 85% of that 100 litres could be water.
Yeah.
You, like, depending on how far you want to
take
it.
Yeah, if you're doubling your strength, you're losing half your stock pretty
much. Yeah. Makes sense, right?
Yeah.
And so that's how you can end up with 30% beers and, you know, was it Snake Bite or something? What's that? The other brand.
Yeah, I think that's fake because
they got in trouble. Yeah, they got busted.
They added neutral spirits to it rather than doing
and they also found out that they were over-representing their alcohol strengths.
Oh, really?
The labels. But yeah, so that's how that technique started. I mean, but it's, you know, the idea is you want to start with your strongest beer to begin with.
Yeah.
To get there. So, you know, for the Icebox. And I'll be interested to know, I don't know the history of how Icebox came about, but surely someone would have just
I reckon it was like an accident or like a really cold winter and they're like, oh fuck, the tanks are frozen.
Yeah.
And then they came out with this awesome beer. Yeah.
Someone walks into the brewery and like, you know, doing snow angels on the brewery floor or something because they're all pretty buggered. That's pretty funny because I remember back when I was like working in the pump house, the guy who was then the head brewer for Weinstephaner came to Australia.
Frank the Tank.
And Frank the Tank told me that they have an allowance of 2 liters of beer a day with the brewers on the floor.
Fuck.
So he would start his day by drinking a liter of beer and then doing his full day's work and then finish the day drinking a full 2 liters of beer. So imagine, like, so I'm sure that's some sort of German tradition and history that passes down. Yeah. So everyone on the brewery floor, that's their allowance of beer for the day. So imagine when someone did the Icebox for the first time. they drank 2 liters of it.
I wouldn't be able to function with just like a regular strength 2 liter beer.
I had a meeting of TUS last night and I barely functioned. So.
God. Yeah. anything else for this this style before we take a break?
Do you have a favorite one?
This is one of them.
Yeah.
Probably this and Salvatore.
Yeah.
The classics.
Yeah, there's a few of them that I would like to try, and Eyinger, I haven't had. Have you had Eyinger before?
I believe I have.
I want to try that one. That's the Celebrator. Yeah, that's the one I really want to try. The Spaten, I haven't seen out here.
No.
No.
Because we have Spaten in Australia, but I'm not sure if I've seen...
And we get the Oktoberfest beer for, you know, the Fest beer.
I'm not sure if I've seen the Doppelbock. I'm sure it's around.
The other one that I want to... The other one I've seen around a lot is the Veltenberger.
Okay.
Yeah, I've seen them around a fair bit. So probably between that, the Paulaner, the Weinstephaner are probably going to be the easiest to get your hands on.
Yeah.
And I think if your local doesn't have them, any local that has the Weinstephaner beers will be able to order in some Corbinian.
Yeah.
And I think if you want to try some of the non-Hefeweizen beers or standard beers from Weinstephaner, I'd definitely get the Corbinian and the Vitus, which is probably my favorite out of their range, which is the Weizenbock, which I really love as well.
Mm.
But yeah.
I'm not sure, actually, like, you know, we were talking about Australian breweries, you know, if any of them have done decoction mashes. I wonder if anyone's done, like, a Doppelbock. I can't really think of any.
I can't think off the top of my head. Surely someone's done one. I'm going to guess, like a Red Hill or...
Oh, yeah. I'm guessing Red Hill probably would have done one.
Would have done one. Yeah. They seem like a brewery that would have Zeeholtz in Canberra?
Yeah, that would make sense.
That would make sense, right?
Yep.
Because they're like a German style brewery.
Yep.
Has Prancing Pony ever done a book?
Not sure.
Because I reckon Frank from Prancing Pony would have. If anyone was doing decoction mashing, I'd probably say maybe Red Hill or Prancing Pony, possibly.
Yeah.
Just because or Zeeholtz, because they all have a. You know, not Red Hill less so has a strong German heritage, but they do very traditional styles of beers like that. So, yeah.
Well, you're going to Canberra soon, right?
I'm going to Canberra very soon. I will.
I feel like you should do some research on this.
I will do some research. I've never been to Zeeholtz before, so I will pop in. I'll report back for next Star Roulette.
Definitely need to know about the Doppelbock situation.
Right. Yeah. Well, let's take a break.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Cool.
The origins of Doppelbock, a distinctly southern German style of beer, can be traced back further north to the town of Einbeck. A style of strong dark ale, made with wheat and roasted barley, was first brewed there as early as the year 1230. In 1368, the town joined the broad-reaching European trading alliance known as the Hanseatic League. Thanks to its alcoholic strength, as well as the channels of distribution afforded by the league, Einbecker beer travelled well and increased in repute. During the 16th century, The brewing industry of Bavaria were looking to emulate the quality and success of this beer, which led to King Ludwig X inviting several brewers from Einbeck to share their skills and knowledge. Eventually, in 1612, Duke Maximilian I convinced brewmaster Elias Pilcher to move from Einbeck to Munich, where he began to make Einbecker beer. The influence of Bavarian brewing traditions gradually caused an evolution of this style of beer. Their penchant for using darker kilned and locally available malts meant wheat took a back seat and was reserved for special releases. The Bavarian technique of lagering beers meant that they typically cold conditioned for months before release, allowing the beer to develop even further. As it turned out, the local dialect would also have a significant impact on the beer, with the name Einbecker eventually evolving into Bock. Bock, by the way, translates to goat in German, and while that bears no relation to how the name of the style came about, many German breweries use goat imagery in their stronger beers to signify that it is a Bock or Doppelbock. You gotta love a good pun, right? Not long after Elias Pilcher came to Munich, another arrival would prove to be pivotal in beer history. Monks from the Order of St. Francis of Paola in Italy settled in Neudeck in the outskirts of Munich and soon established the Neudeck ob der Au Monastery in about 1627. They began brewing beer there from at least 1634, which is considered the establishment date for what is now known as the Paulaner Brewery. The monks would generally make beer for their own consumption, with any leftover being given to the poor or sold to locals in the monastery taverns as a source of income for the cloister. They would also treat beer as liquid bread during Lent, when they were not allowed to eat solid food. Not satisfied with a standard bock during these hard times, the monks developed an even stronger version in 1651, and the first Doppelbock was born. They initially called this beer Sankt Vatersöl, meaning oil of the Sacred Father, which was pretty cheeky because consumption of plant oil was allowed during Lent. Eventually, it became fittingly known as Salvator, or Saviour. Soon it became tradition to tap the first barrel of this special brew each year on the 2nd of April to commemorate St. Francis of Paola. Back then, the monks were not technically allowed to sell beer to the public, but this didn't stop people showing up in droves for a taste during Lent. Despite protests from other local brewers, in 1751, the Prince Elector Maximilian III Joseph officially legalized the sale of the beer during the feast days, with Elector Karl Theodor extending that right to year-round in 1777. From here, the Stark Beer Festival, as it became known, would continue to gain popularity until 1799, when the brewery was disbanded, thanks to some jerk named Napoleon, who wanted to secularize businesses in the region. Paulaner was saved by brewer Franz Xaver Zacherl, who rented the brewery in 1806 and eventually bought it outright in 1813. He resurrected the Salvator tradition and fought against other breweries copying the name. Zacherl passed away in 1849, but his wish eventually became reality, with Paulaner being granted exclusive use of the name Salvator. With the reopening of the brewery came the return of the Stark Beer Festival on the Nockerberg, which is effectively Paulaner's beer garden, and this tradition continues on to this day. In fact, it is Germany's oldest beer festival, predating even Oktoberfest. While that more popular festival has international acclaim, the locals have a particular soft spot for dark beer drinking during Lent. They're so passionate about it, in fact, that it turned violent one time. In 1888, a mass brawl broke out between soldiers and civilians. This got so out of control that a 50-man unit of heavy cavalry had to be called in to break it up. And the reason for the brawl? The locals were unhappy about the increase in price of Salvator beer. True story. Doppelbock is one of those styles that has stood the test of time. Paulaner claims that their Salvator recipe remains largely unchanged from the 1770s, and hundreds of breweries still have a Doppelbock in their portfolio, many having the suffix "ator" in their names as a tribute.
Sessionable.
Ever been in a work function and it's just cheap drinks on a boat for like the fifth year in a row, and you think to yourself, ugh, I wish I was doing something fun? Well, Dave's Travel and Events Group can help you out with that. With Dave's Events, they can hook you up with some great team-building activities like axe throwing. Or they can curate a nice degustation matched with some good beer. Or they can even help you brew your own beer for your staff and clients. Whatever your needs, Dave's Events can customize an awesome local beer experience for your workplace. So it doesn't have to be just drinks in a boat. Although it can totally be drinks in a boat. For more info, check out daves.com.au. And we're back.
Awesome. Thank you for your story time, Adrian. Yeah. That was really good.
It's been a while since I've done one.
Yeah, I've always wanted to do more of them. I think there's certain styles that lend themselves better to story time.
Yeah, especially like the kind of older European ones.
Yeah.
So should we get to some quick recommendations?
You sure can, yeah. What do you want to do first?
Let's go non-beer.
Non-beer?
Yeah.
My non-beer recommendation is to get Red Dead Redemption 2.
Oh, really?
It is so fucking awesome. Yeah.
I was thinking about getting it recently, but like I've heard stories about the control scheme being a bit weird.
It's okay. Nah, yeah. It's all right. It took me a little getting used to. There was some things where like I would accidentally shoot people. When
yeah,
I didn't mean
that's
to,
what I've heard.
And got, but then
it's
I,
like,
I've
yeah, so let me punch
that.
Your horse and stuff. Like
yeah, that. Yeah, yeah, which is really bad. I feel bad for him, but yeah, yeah, my horse is called Black Bob. but yeah, no, Red Dead Redemption 2. If you've ever played any of the original one,
I never played the original, but I played Red Dead Redemption.
Yeah,
I didn't play Red Dead Revolver.
Which was the OG. Yeah, I don't think I've ever played Revolver. I played Red Dead Redemption 2, really liked it. Yeah, it's like those GTA games where, like, but you could, the story is always awesome.
Yeah.
But just the scope of what you can do. Like,
yeah.
Who was I speaking to someone the other day who spent 4 hours fishing in the game? or like going hunting.
Yeah.
Or like, yeah. Yeah, it's really cool. But yeah, if you're into that type of thing, that's my recommendation.
Yeah, definitely want to check it out.
If you're thinking about doing it, getting the game, I would say do it, but make sure you've got a good chunk of time aside.
Yeah, definitely.
To go into it.
That's probably why I haven't bought it yet. But
that was my post-beer week treat to myself, was to buy Red Dead Redemption.
I reckon like once the Christmas season kind of dies down, I might pick it up and, you know, put some time in it.
Yeah, it's not one of those games like you have to play this right now, but
it'll always be there.
Yeah.
I still haven't played GTA 5, so I think maybe I'll pick that up first.
GTA 5 is good, and like, the good thing is you can pick up GTA. It's like,
it's like 25 now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They're super cheap. Yeah. So GTA 5 is good. Yeah.
Yeah. I actually, I bought it for Xbox 360 when it first came out, and I just never played it.
Mm.
So I own it, but then now I kind of want to get it on Xbox One.
Yeah.
For the graphics upgrade.
Yeah. It's the same thing, I guess, with Red Dead Redemption. I don't have the pro PS4 whatever.
Yeah.
But apparently, the 4K version of it is, pretty... Yeah. Or even, the potato version of it's pretty amazing. So, yeah. What about yourself?
So, my non-beer recommendation is the latest series of Doctor Who, which I've just started watching. I'm about a couple of episodes in, but I think there's 11 episodes out now.
Yeah, cool.
So the big thing this series
female doctor,
the new regeneration of the doctor for the first time is a woman.
Yeah.
And it's the same showrunner as Broadchurch, if anyone's ever watched Broadchurch.
I think I recommended Broadchurch in a previous episode.
You probably have, yeah. You definitely did Happy Valley.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think I watched Happy Valley and then went into Broadchurch
after that. Yeah.
Happy Valley's more fucked up.
Yeah, I heard. Yeah.
You should watch it. It's good. Yeah.
But yeah, so it is actually really fucking good. Like, it's I think the new Doctor, you know, the choice of the new Doctor and the new showrunner has really injected a lot of life.
So what does the showrunner, what's a showrunner's influence on it?
They do the main story arc. You know, the direction of where the story's going.
So I'd say Doctor Who, each episode has a different director.
Each episode would have a different director and a writer, but the showrunner would usually typically write a few. They would typically write a few episodes and they control the whole season for, you know, however long they work on the show.
Yeah, right. Okay, cool. So that's a pretty important role.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So it's actually...
No pressure, with Doctor Who as well, right?
But... There's so much that they've changed. I guess it's always, Doctor Who's always kind of touched on, you know, a diverse representation of, you know, races and gender. But
Doctor Who was always a world travel, a universal experience person, right?
But this one is just there's three companions and, you know, two of them are black. One of them's a woman. One of them's an older guy. The doctor's a woman. The writing is super political as well.
Ah, okay.
Surprisingly so.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, without watching it, I don't want to sound, you know, slack, but have they gone too far in trying to cover everything, or is it...
No, absolutely not. No, and it's still, like, classic Doctor Who, like... Yeah. You know, if you've never watched it, you can jump in now and enjoy it. If you've been a long-time fan, you'll still love it.
Because, you know, I haven't watched every Doctor Who and all that stuff, but, you know, living with Tom and people like that, you know, I've watched, and I like David Tennant as an actor, so I watched some of his Doctor Who stuff is really good.
Yeah.
What's the general consensus? Is Whovians up in arms, or are they digging it?
I do not know, to be honest.
Yeah.
If they don't like it, they're wrong. I'm not like a hardcore Whovian, so I'm not sure. But I think it's been...
you're enjoying it?
It's been generally well received from people I've talked to.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's on ABC iView, so completely free to watch.
The last Doctor Who's were the guys who were from League of Gentlemen. Were they the showrunners for those ones?
Because
they were also doing that Sherlock Holmes thing on the side when they were... The other BBC show,
Not sure. I think Stephen Moffat was the last showrunner.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what else he's done.
So. Yeah, he's from the League of Gentlemen.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
All right, cool. So he's finished up now and someone else has taken over the reins.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah,
awesome.
So they've killed off Peter Capaldi. He's regenerated into a woman.
Yeah.
I was always weirded out by Peter Capaldi as the Doctor because he was just not swearing enough. Because I'm used to him being in the thick of it,
where he
would swear like every single scene. Every single scene he's in, he's swearing.
He had the best use of swear words. Like it was like, it was. Oh god, such a good swearer.
Yeah.
Cool. Awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Beer recommendations.
Yeah. Do you have one?
We said yesterday was Tusk Day.
Yeah.
And there was some of the best things I love about things like Tusk Day is all the other feral beers that you don't always see around. You know, seeing BFH again. But I was at the Flodge last night and we drained the keg of BFH and then they put on the Citrus Hog. Have you had the Citrus Hog? I think they released it as a part of this 10-year hog thing. I actually really like it.
It's kind of like Coke Life.
But I generally like, particularly with the Americans when I do these like citrus beers, it's like some of them I've had added cordial, like it feels like they've added Fanta into the beer.
Yeah, yeah.
Where this towed the line of, it's a citrus IPA, but it was, I don't know, I really liked it. Yeah, it's very smashable.
I don't think I had that one. We had the Tropical Hog on the live podcast.
Yes, yeah.
But I'm not sure if I tried the citrus. Mm. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah, well, that's good. Yeah. That's gonna be my recommendation.
Actually, my recommendation is a similar story. Like, I went to the Albert to try Tusk, and they also had the Modus Operandi Tropic Haze, which is their latest hazy IPA.
Latest in a long list of hazy IPAs from Modus. Yeah,
it's actually like, I'm not sure if they call it a New England. It was definitely hazy, but it had like a really sharp hop character, which I really like really super fresh. I'm going to be honest, I was quite drunk, so I can't really remember if it was...
You're tasting those.
Yeah, if it was juicy.
Yeah, yeah.
But I really enjoyed it. Like, it was good. It was a nice, fresh IPA, and that's what I was after, especially, like, after, like, having that alcohol bomb of Tusk.
Another one, just to throw it out there, that I had last night and I really enjoyed is the Wayward Passionista.
Oh, is that the Passion of the Puss rebrand?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I like a lot better than as a name than Passion of the Puss, I have to...
Yeah. I actually really like the name. It's cool.
Passionista?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole puss thing was, I don't know, it wasn't my bag.
Yeah.
But beer was always great. So yeah, really good. And I don't know, it just, without trying to be a ripoff, it's very Passiona.
Yeah,
themed. That's what you want. Say. I'd say it's an ode to Passione without.
Yeah,
instead
yeah.
of like, you know, the, you know.
Oh, is that
of,
the label? Or,
decal and the artwork.
Yep,
yeah,
cool.
But it's done very well. Unlike, you know, not to bag out other breweries, but you know, some people have like done like beers that are meant to be like a dessert or something like that, and it almost looks like the cherry ripe and such a thing. So instead of trying to make it look like it, it's just it's an ode to it, I guess.
Yeah,
you'd say.
It kind of takes the essence of it rather than doing a complete rip off.
Exactly right. Yeah. But another really great beer. It's so funny because like you go to Tusk Day and it's like, I didn't start with a Tusk and it's like, you're trying to work out when in your session you're actually going to have the tuss that you came here for.
Yep.
But it was probably about 3 or 4 beers in before I was like, I think I'm ready to have a tuss now. Like,
Yeah.
Alrighty. Do we need to figure out what our next style is going to be?
Oh, shit. Yeah. Let's do a quick roll.
I've got the dice in my bag, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, I bet we take a quick break and we got to do some rolling and we'll come back.
Yep.
Sessionable.
All right. So we've rolled.
I'm excited.
Yeah. This one's really good. You guys will be very excited.
So we rolled. So we got 23 first.
Yep.
So 23 is European sour ales.
Yep.
And at first, like, oh, what's that? Then you look at it, you're like, oh, Berliner Weiss, Flanders Red Ale, Oud Bruin, Lambic, Gers, Fruit Lambic.
OG sours.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've touched on, like, Brett beers before, and now we're kind of going to the source.
Yeah.
And going, what kind of inspired this revolution? And so, yeah, European sour beers, and we've rolled 2, which means B, which is Flanders Red Ale, which is, like, one of my favorite styles of all time.
I'm putting this out there. Can we maybe combine Flanders and Oud Bruin together?
Yeah, that'd be cool. Yeah, let's do it. And they're both closely related as well.
Regionality style-wise, it's just like ones with wood, ones with steel sort of a thing. But I think I would, I reckon we combine it and do Flanders Red Ale / Oud Bruins.
There you go.
There's some awesome stuff out at the moment.
So, watch out for our next style roulette. Do your research, drink some Flanders Reds and Oud Bruins.
If you've got a favourite Oud Bruin or Flanders Red that you want us to have on the episode, let us know. We'll definitely do our damnedest to get it. There's a lot in the style out there at the moment.
I know exactly what I'm bringing for the Flanders Red for that one.
Gonna start with an R, I'm gonna guess, right?
Yeah. Alrighty.
Cool.
Thanks everyone for listening today. If you like the show, please rate and review us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, as it's called these days. And all our contact details are on sessionable.net. So check it out.
Cheers. Thanks, guys.